Welcome. We're recording another episode of the Lean Into Artcast. I'm Rob Stenzinger, and I have with me here Jersey Drozd.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jersey. And we actually are joined with special guest Dave Say today. And what's this thing? Who are we? And what's this guest doing? The Lean Into Artcast is a place where we gather every couple weeks to record our thoughts about the process of being storytellers and visual storytellers in particular, trying to work through process and interesting things we run into. And We break it all down. We like to get nerdy and brainy about it and do our best, even if we're stumped. And once in a while, we bring in special help, like Dave Say.
Yes.
So David Say of davidsay.com, who probably the amount of times he's been mentioned on the show rivals the amount of times Ryan Estrada has been mentioned on our show. Wow. So with that said, I was thinking about today. I was like, well, if Ryan Estrada is my Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost, that would make David Say my Yoda ghost.
Yes.
Because that's when Yoda comes along, that's when things get real.
When things get real. I do look good in a robe, too, ladies.
Gotta love the comfortable Jedi attire, but
yeah, this fleece is like really comfortable. My sister gave this to me for Christmas. It's Jedi quality. Oh, that cat just like walked over my microphone.
That's what makes it a good podcast. So, how do we want to get things rolling here, Jersey? I mean, a lot of times when we have a guest, we eschew the format that we've been adopting, where we start up high and then we drill down low.
And we usually kick off with a curveball.
Yeah.
And the curveball is a way to get our brains, you know, fired up and get us tackling a very difficult question that we don't think we can do. And the idea is to, you know, do a little bit of stretching and sparring before we get into the real practice of the work. Now, I don't have a curveball ready. So I thought, and I hope this is not undue presumptive of me, but I am curious, based on the topics of this idea of a curveball, I'm wondering what Mr. Say would have to suggest for different kinds of curveballs that you do. Because we should say that you are a designer and a thinker. You define yourself as a stationary designer these days.
Yeah, I was trying that on this year.
But you think a lot about thinking and designing and how to visualize your work and your process and your time. And I'm wondering, are there any like little mental tricks you play on yourself to get yourself spun up for the day? Because that's what we're trying to do with the curveball when we do it on the show.
Okay. Well, lately I've been doing – well, if I go back and think overall, like over the history of me trying to identify as a designer, it's taken me a long time to even think of myself as a designer or an artist, because I started out as a computer programmer. I was going to be a English major when I was in high school. That's when microcomputers came out, and I got kind of sucked into the world of playing games. I said, like, it would be cool to make these things. So I went to engineering school, and to keep sane in engineering school, I kept making shareware graphics. And when I graduated, I realized that I don't really know what I want to do with this engineering thing. Maybe I should go to grad school. So I went to grad school, and that pretty much helped me see that I didn't want to be doing that. So then I applied to art school at that point. But I've been like feeling like I've been in another place, moving into a place where I didn't quite belong. And my upbringing, I grew up as a family of missionaries overseas. Mm-hmm. So there were no business people, not really any artists, a lot of people who were on a mission, really. I didn't realize just how much that had shaped me growing up, growing around with people who really were comfortable on a mission. But what's my mission? It wasn't being part of the church. It wasn't being an engineer. So there's just been this search for the past, 20 years or so, to find out, what is it that I am? And so for me, the big trick is, how do I define that a little bit better for myself to give myself the faith to move on and take that next step? Because there were years of confusion. Like, all right, am I a designer? If I'm a designer, what does that mean? Does it mean I design things? I don't really like making things look pretty. I have a terrible sense of color. The other designers seem to be very comfortable with that. Does that mean I'm not a designer, or am I a certain kind of designer? And if I don't know what kind of designer I am, how can I sell my services to people? You know, those were the kind of issues that went over and over and over in my head. Mm. It's only like in the, I guess I, since I started, maybe 3 or 4 years after I started blogging, having gotten a grip on the patterns that seem to recur in my writing. A lot of them were about, well, what am I? What am I doing? A lot of them are cataloging the things I was interested in and trying to find the patterns of that. That's probably where a lot of my more introspective posts come from. And then the dawning realization that there was no one expert in telling me who I was. That was going to have to be me. And taking those small steps to discover, well, let me try making this thing. Maybe it won't kill me if it comes out badly. Maybe if I showed this to somebody, something would happen and I won't die. Or my reputation won't be irreparably compromised.
Okay.
And I think one thing that reinforced this feeling was when I started writing my blog and got like some recognition for it, and people saying, I really love the stuff that you made. I don't know what it is exactly, but I love it. That was the first time that I was recognized for work I was doing for myself in a public setting, as opposed to working for another company, being part of another team. But I made this thing, I put it out there because no one could stop me. And I wasn't thinking straight enough to, like, you know, keep it hidden on my hard drive. But when I did that, it opened up all kinds of opportunities that I didn't imagine. I couldn't have imagined. And that became the process, I think, of which I started, I've been using since then, starting with the very, very first form that I made, which I called the Concrete Goals Tracker. And the idea behind that is two principles. One, if you make something, you got to show it to someone. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. And in the process of doing that, I discovered all kinds of things that I never would anticipate. The blog that post got popular because it's like one, you know, more famous designer, I think it was 456 Beria Street, that blog, when I was part of this blog network, said, I think this is cool. And he posted it as a side link, and I'm like, I got 200 hits. I said, I've never had 200 hits before. And that gave me a taste of, like, so that's what this feels like. I want to feel this all the time. And that's kind of where I got started. So everything I've done since then has been, I would say, based on that fundamental idea that you make something, you put it in the world, you see what happens. And if you don't die, you do it again.
Well, there's a lot in there that I want to pick apart here. But the first one I want to start in reverse chronological order is that you use the language, you have to show it to someone or it doesn't matter. Now, I'll just embarrass you and say publicly that I love your writing. I adore your writing. And actually, it was my wife who introduced me to it, because my work schedule was a catastrophe 2 years ago. Yeah. And whenever a client would come to me and say, like, how long is this going to take? How long is that going to take? I'd be like, I don't know, 4 hours, you know? But anyway, we'll get to the ETP stuff and how I've been talking about it on the show a lot lately. But where I'm going with this is that you journal your work on your site, and it's often in great detail, and you spell it all out. This is what, for instance, we're in February. It's the beginning of the Groundhog's Day resolutions, which I want to talk about a little bit. And you spell out, here are my goals for the year. Here's the time I'm going to check in. I'm going to blog this stuff and I'm going to share it with you. Journaling in public. I'm sure that you benefit from crystallizing your thoughts in writing, but if we could dig in a little bit deeper into specifically, what benefits have you derived from going public with it? Because you don't have to. You could have just left this in a notebook. And also, how did the work change as a result of the feedback loop that begins when you start to share this stuff publicly?
Since I can remember only one thing at a time, I'm going to have
I'll repeat it for you.
What was the first part again?
The first part is, what benefits do you derive by sharing publicly?
What benefits I derive by sharing publicly? There's this compulsion I have to share what I'm learning. And it might just very well be habit by this time. When I first started blogging, like as I mentioned, it was to discover some patterns in what I was doing. And no one was reading my website, but at the same time, I needed to have one because ostensibly I was a freelance designer at that point. I'd left a job I was in when I developed a sudden allergy to marketing. And so I can't have a regular marketing website. I can't say, here's my services, here's my clients, here's a few white papers, here's what you need to know about interactive. But it was, so I said, well, that was when WordPress 1.0 was out. So it was either movable type or WordPress 1.0. I started writing it. No one was reading it. But then a few friends of mine mentioned that, you know, it's, who I hadn't seen in a while, people I knew from the Rochester Institute of Technology, said, like, Dave, it's kind of cool that you're doing this because it's like you're here again. It's like we're hanging out. Because I have a more conversational way of writing rather than like, well, let me give you the bullet points and here's the business case for that. So I started writing for that very small audience of my friends. And other people found it, and I guess because I was writing in this way, they felt like I was their friend too. And then eventually, you know, I made connections like that and so forth. So it's a habit in that sense. And one thing that keeps me doing that is also remembering when I was trying to learn how to program BASIC on the TRS-80. I didn't understand it at all. There were people who took the time out of their day to say, okay, I know you're a seventh grader and I'm a senior, and I shouldn't even be talking to you because it's damaging. But I feel your pain about wanting to make that text stay on the screen for 3 seconds before the next text appears. So you need a for next loop. I said, thank you, oh senior. And so you know, that kind of pay it forward attitude was very important to me. So when I share things, when I'm sharing things that are difficult with me, for me, I recognize, you know, there was a time when it was difficult, you know, it's not difficult for me now, but I know there are other people who are going through this sort of thing. And if I find one person who's in that place and they get some glimmering of an idea, like, okay, well, this guy doesn't know what he's doing either. And he's writing about it. That gives me some ideas, and I don't feel quite so alone for that. That's one reason why I do that. The second thing is, this was an insight I had about what kind of designer or creative I was. I'm fundamentally a writer. I have to write to think, to linearize my thoughts, to categorize them. It's my most effortless process. Everything else is a giant pain in the butt. If I had to draw something or if I had to code something, I have to actually write it first. So I'll sit and I'll freeze to associate. So, all right, I'm imagining like a spaceship trading card. It's got to have text all over it. It's got to be this. And then I'll just sort of free associate like that. And then that's how I get to a certain kind of conceptual certainty. And because the other element is like, I don't like uncertainty at all or unsurety. And for a long time, it was a huge block. And the writing process helps limber that up. It helps me imagine in higher resolution, and it's for me, it's very effortless. I can type as fast as I think, which is you know, a blessing. Something I learned from when I was a kid. I was just very impatient about. I go back then, we didn't have, you know, graphical user interfaces, so if you wanted to see what was on your floppy disk, you'd have to type catalog. And so I got really fast at typing catalog. catalog. And I had to turn the memory too, so I had to be typing it constantly, and that developed a lot of speed. So I knew where all the C, A, and T words, letters, and M is somewhere below there, and eventually I just got to the point which I learned how to type very fast the wrong way, which prevented me from getting carpal tunnel syndrome because I don't do the straight-on hands, I do the curved hands.
Like, oh, this. Wow.
So I don't break my wrist, which is like the big issue. Getting on a tangent there. What was the second question? Did I answer the first question?
Yeah, I think you did. There was like a lot of just built-in generosity and then also a sense of addiction that comes out of – or compulsion that comes out of sharing things, getting into that feedback loop. So that leads me to feedback loop, mm-hmm. which is how does the work change when you start to share publicly? Because a lot of our audience is people who are just starting out in creative work, and I'm wondering if we can give them a sense of what to expect, of what begins to change the moment you get into that feedback cycle with an audience.
That's an interesting question. I haven't been aware of a change. But I do segregate the work that I do. Like when I'm doing client work, I don't share their work. I don't even mention who they are a lot of the time. I mean, I use initials and things like that because that's their work. So the work that I'm doing publicly, I'm not really thinking about the audience, really, when I'm sharing the work. I'm writing down what I'm thinking, what I'm going through. And the most that I'll do is I might make a second or third pass on the blog post that results out of that, just to make sure it's clear. And this is a relatively recent thing that I do, too. For most of the years, I would just write one pass and then post it. And so there's grammar errors and missing words and like stuff like this. Yeah, but my friend Colleen Wainwright, who's a real writer, was telling about her process and how she'll go through like hundreds of hours refining a paper or a talk that she'll give at like one of these big venues. And I was going, wow, that sounds so cool. And so I'm thinking here, and so here I am just like you, just whipping these words out, and you're not really, like you were saying, not being as respectful of people's time. You know, there's that saying that I did not have time to write a short letter, so I wrote you a long letter. So I've been trying to do that, be more mindful of that, especially in the past month or so, past month or two. I've been making a lot more edit passes. So for me, the work hasn't really changed. It's the way I'm presenting it is, but the process of doing that has not. Maybe the key is that once I got used to putting the work out there, this concept that Brené Brown talks about, like if you've seen her TED talk on the power of vulnerability, mm-hmm. which is that they see putting out those, making yourself vulnerable in this way is fundamental if you want to be wholehearted, if you want to grow. And I think that's something I've always believed, you know, deep down in my heart. If I am doing this to share, I'm doing it because I stand for this principle. I stand for, like, I have to share this. I have to put this work out there, even though it might be bad, even though I may be embarrassed about it. But the very act of putting it out there transforms the work in my mind into, it's not about me anymore. It's me about living this principle. And that might sound, it's more noble sounding than I really intended to sound, but I don't even think about how the work is going to be perceived. I'll check my stats to see if people are looking at it. But in the moment of making it, it's something else that's driving it, I think. And I think that might be fairly unique to me. This might be the teacher mentality, or I don't know.
I think that's a terrific way of thinking about it, because I think what you've done is you bypass stage fright, right? When you're just becoming one with the performance of the act of doing something. Well, okay, we could get into stage fright in a second here, but right. But it's like what stops a lot of people that I've talked to, a lot of students that I've worked with, is what if people say it's no good, and they're thinking about it before they even sat down to write anything or draw anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, let's bypass that and let's just actually make something first. Then we'll figure out what you're going to do about when somebody says this or that about it, right? That's what mm-hmm. I mean. Yeah, Rob, you look like you have something, you got something percolating in there.
Well, one or two things. I actually want to go all the way back to this phrase, conceptual certainty.
I know. Wasn't that good?
Yeah, it's awesome. So what I feel like I understand your direction, Dave, when you're talking about orientating based on principles, discovering principles. They become, and this is me paraphrasing my own description of it, but I'm theorizing it's essentially a way to have waypoints along creative paths and choices to say that I navigate based on these waypoints, and this is what I have tested and, you know, explored these parts enough where I believe in these waypoints and they allow me to have some consistency.
Mm. Belief is a good way of putting it. I think before, when the not so distant past, when I was stopped from trying something or didn't want to start something. I would be, for example, let's say like, you know, I should make an awesome mini game. I'll learn to do some IS programming. I'll get back into the coding stuff and I'll make this thing. And the first thing I think of and this might be from, you know, years of project management. All right, let me figure out the risk. This is going to take a long time. I'm going to need a team of three people. I need this expertise. You know, I'm going to have to make some killer graphics. So let's say at least five screens. I know it takes me an average of 40 hours per screen, so we're up to 200 hours there. I have no idea what the screens are yet or what the game is. You know, I really wish I'd like learned Modo like I promised myself 3 years ago, because I could use a really nice. And so what happens is builds up in my head is like all these things I want to do, and then all of a sudden, like, it's like, oh, I would love to be able to do this. It becomes wishful thinking, though. But it's like, what I'm certain about is it's going to take a lot of time, and I don't know if it's going to be good. I don't know where even to start. And what happens, it becomes this huge blocking point. And on top of it, like, I may make something and I'm not very happy with it. You know, those are all issues, I think, that rise up. And so it's much easier to eat a chocolate chip cookie than to, you know, just start any one of these.
I would like some dopamine. Where can I pick some up?
Yeah, like, oh, I'm sleepy. Maybe if I take a nap, then I'll start it tomorrow, and then, you know, something else happens. But, you know, this is maybe jumping around a bit, but last November I did the National Novel Writing Month thing for the first time, because I had, you know, I knew friends that were doing it, and I'd been aware of it, and I just think it's a cool idea. And so, someone mentioned it to me, and said, like, I should do it! And so I committed to it, and, you know, had, like, in the first few days, like, had an experience of, like, you know, not preparing for it at all, and realizing I was, like, totally stuck. But I decided to just work through and just get words out. And that taught me creative process that I think I'd been lacking. So after that, I had faith that, like, working through the uncertainty. The uncertainty is like when you're getting warm. And then on top of that is just the idea of practice and continual movement. And having some way of collecting or consolidating the effort you've made in a way you can look back. You know, going back to the blogging aspect of things, maybe one thing that helped with that is just seeing all those posts accrue and knowing that not all of them are really great, but, you know, there were some things that, like, made me laugh. Every time I post something nerdy about, like, you know, some graphic artist I used to like, you know, back in the Amiga days or something like that, there are things I can look back now and see that, like, every day I'm piling up these things. I'm getting feedback of producing something. And after a certain point, I could credibly say, like, I guess I could say I'm a writer, or I guess I could say I'm a blogger. And that would give me some additional confidence in what I was doing. Just having a big pile of crap that has your name on it, I guess, that's a huge confidence booster.
You could say you could call it evidence or a big pile of crap. But, yeah, I mean, even the most nagging doubt can't deny, you know, all these posts once they've built up, right?
But I like what there's some language in there, Dave, that you use that we've used on the show is like you go back and you look and you say, hey, this one thing that's nice. The kid was thinking here, right? You get some of your own evidence to reinforce this idea in your own head that maybe I do have, you know, some sense of what I want to do, but. I think we're going around this idea of like operating principles too, right? Getting to this certainty, these principles can become a waypoint. This is something you've been blogging about recently too.
Yes.
You've been posting about it with your publicizing your process and publicizing your work, the Trello board, and you have right one of the tabs on there is these are my operating principles for the year. Rob and I have talked extensively about his code of arms. Rob has the Stenzinger code of arms, which helps define what project I should take on next. I still have yet to get this darn thing. So I'm curious from both of you guys is like how has having a set of operating principles informed what you should do next? Or has it helped you with that? Are you still working your way through it?
I think maybe starting with Rob would be a good idea here.
Without a doubt, I'm still working my way through it because what I've realized, it's almost like I had some confidence that I had crystallized some tools into existence that I could use as thought exercise to say, this is me getting closer to where I want to go. And for me, what I realized is what I thought was a coat of arms is actually an algorithm to generate a coat of arms. And this year in planning my goals, I got closer to it, and I'd have to dig around to share it. And I'm still working on getting the Dave Say level of sharing that much, that kind of thing. But the formula was me filling in these answers. But the questions are, how do I do what I love for a community I care about using tools and methods I believe in to engage in a sustainable trade?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think my operating principles grew out of a similar desire. It sounds very similar to what you're talking about. I had once figured out that there are certain things that made me, for whatever reason, just happy. There was no need to justify or rationalize this. I just realized that there was maybe only two or three things in my life that made me happy. One of them was cats. When I see a cat, I become inordinately, I just like lose all sense of place and time. That there's a cat. What does it mean? What is this about? What is it thinking? It's fuzzy. What is it? It moves in an interesting way. What's this person like? For some reason, and I can't tell you why, they draw my attention in a way that is very, it makes me happy. It makes me pleasurable. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, and this used to be an individual thing, but I realize it's a general class of observation, is I used to like to see like women who were overcoming adversity. Like Gilmore Girls is one of my favorite shows because of that.
Oh, are you kidding me? No, I used to have stress nightmares when the season when they introduced Jess into the show. He's no good for Rory.
He's no good. He's the kid. But maybe it'll be a good learning experience for her. She can handle it. I'm sure she can handle it.
That's true.
Yeah. Lorelai, maybe not. But anyway. I forgot what I was talking about. I went to
women overcoming adversity.
Yeah, but then I realized it was just in general, like any kind of overcoming of adversity by someone who didn't realize I had that power. The moment, the catalyzing insight. I said, wait a moment. I can totally do this thing by myself. And it's awesome. It would be anyone who, like maybe a kid realizing like, oh, I didn't know I could start my own business. That would be neat. Let's do that. And then being in the place where you can observe it, like a friendly version of the observers on Fringe or something like that, to be able to be part of the catalyzing action or influence. This may be another reason why I post some of these things that I do, because you know someone might get some idea from it. You know, like if someone is comfortable talking about the things that they don't know and figuring it out publicly, well, maybe. And he's not dead now. Maybe that applies to me.
I bet that one's gonna get him. Oh no, he got another post.
No, I probably should push harder on that. You know, but yeah. So the two things from there. That's where I derived my operating principles. And I realized, okay, these are the people I want to hang out with. Self-empowered, positive-minded, conscientious, kind, competent people. If I can be around these kind of people, and if I can be a meaningful participant in those kind of activities, that's how I want my life to be. And now, in the next step, how can I make a living doing that?
Exactly.
You got that part figured out? Because I would love the secret of that one.
Well, the secret came to me, the part of the secret, I think this might be the secret, is when I was reading Tom Hodgkinson's The Freedom Manifesto, which is a book that my sister, who commutes every day from Providence to Boston, had picked up when she was in a very foul mood and at the Boston South Station train station. And it made her feel so much better that she bought a copy for me. And it basically is a manifesto about like how, you know, the world is too busy. We're working to make money, to buy big houses we don't need. Wouldn't it be nice if we were back in the Middle Ages, which is the comparison time period he uses, when you didn't have a lot of rent. I'm sure you were a serf, but rents were reasonable. What you lived for was to work for a few hours a day and have enough money to buy, you know, some cigarettes and some beer to hang out with your friends. And this ties in also with something that I got out of Richard Kiyosaki, I think his name is. I had read his Rich Dad, Poor Dad book, you know, one year to see if it was as questionable as some people had told me about. But I did get two good ideas out of it. One of them was what wealth was. Wealth is having enough. And the idea of not spending money on things that are not assets, things that do not build your practice, things that do not build your ability to pursue more and bigger things. So
Brewster's Millions, right? That was one of the rules of Brewster's Millions. He couldn't accrue any assets when he spent that $1 million in 30 days.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, the Richard Pryor movie?
No, I haven't seen this. I'm terrible for seeing movies.
Oh, so,
you just had to tell me which movies to see. Like,
although I have seen that one. See, this is this is like a common thing, a recurring thing on the show, is Jersey will bring up a reference from a movie, and then look, see the puzzle look on my face and go, "Hey, haven't you seen that movie?"
And my parents owned a video store, so
Parker Lewis.
Yeah. So my formative years were spent working in my parents' video store, so I watched a lot of movies. But yeah, that was one of the basic ideas, that he couldn't have any assets for this money spending challenge. So anyway, continue. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's a good interruption. So I forgot what the question was. We're talking about
wealth, defining wealth, and having enough. Yep. And
yeah, so what is enough? Yeah, so if I made like a very small list of what I need, so there's what I want and what I need. What I need right now is to make enough money to pay for the roof over my head and to, you know, to subsist. And that actually ends up not being a lot of money if I think about it. It's probably, so my goal internally is like if I can make $100 a day profit, you know, that would be enough to sustain things, and I could spend all my time working or whatever I felt like it, building assets, building projects, and you know, continuing to build. Because although that's a sustainable amount of money, I do want the big pile of money so I can do things like hire developers or buy really expensive software, build machine shops, buy that Viking oven that I have. You know, the kind of things I want to buy generally are things that give me more capability. And, you know, one of the dreams that I often talk about with people that I work with is like, wouldn't it be great if we could buy like, you know, a few acres of land, build a nice facility with like world-class internet, a helipad, a bowling alley, a world-class kitchen, some nice guest bungalows, a skeet range, and just have creative retreats there. So people just come over and says, you know, I want to work on a book, or I've got this thing, or I just want to hang out with some people and learn how to make some stuff. That you seem to have here.
Wow. Yeah, so imagine like the impromptu projects you could come up with and just...
Yeah, so now they call them maker spaces, or hacker spaces, I should say. I went to our local hacker space, and then I got very, very shy because I became aware that I didn't know how to do anything. So I didn't know which end of the tool to hold. Like, I didn't know. All these people were really knowledgeable, and it was like a very interesting experience. It was like, wow, this is what it's like to be a noob again. And I don't like it at all. I need to get over this. I need to, like, figure out how to engage with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, that's a whole other topic. But, you know, so I'm just trying to, like, you know, so my operating principles these days, you know, they're very similar to Rob's, in that there are certain things that I believe in are good, and there are certain things that I wish I could make that were up to that level of quality. Before, I didn't know how excellence and quality fit into what I was doing. I would say like this, the past 7 years have been a stage of really just kind of discovering my own operating parameters. Let them know, I didn't know what the principles were, but what seems to make me work. You know, am I a night owl? I think I'm a night owl. Do I have attention issues? How much affirmation do I really need? What's the basis of my sense of competence and confidence? Why do people hire me in the first place? What is it that my friends see in me? Why? Well, how am I contributing to the lives of other people? Do I even really want to do that? How selfish am I willing to be? How selfish is too selfish? These kind of issues. And so I came to a number of conclusions over the years. I'm pretty selfish, you know, and I try to be very honest about that. At the same time, I am driven to, I love to see people overcome adversity, but I don't want to be the person who yanks them over the adversity threshold. There has to be a certain level of, like, I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to put my time into it. And I'm glad you're here to spot me for this. And, you know, maybe I need a little bit of help. Maybe I don't need help, but you know, there's a kind of parity in intention that's there. Those are some of the things that I've discovered. And it's, you know, when it comes down to taking on projects, what's the right project? The right project is when the client is willing to engage just as much as I am in a project. So a project for me that's not so good is when, well, we need someone to do this really excellent job creating or defining this thing. And you'll, well, I'll be complete hands-off, and I'll just tell you if it's right or not. Oof. Bad project for me.
Yeah.
Good project for me is like, all right, I'm trying to figure this out. I'd like to hire you for like 3 or 4 hours of time just to pick your brain and come up with some things. I want to make this interactive thing, or I want to write this book, or I want to start this project. And I just want to talk to someone, you know, the sounding board service I offered for a few years to get me over this thing. And I want to share what I'm doing with you. And those are very, very rare projects. So this, which ties into the, well, how much, what's the minimum that I need? I mean, it'd be great to be making like even like $5,000 or $6,000 a month, but I could probably get away with like $1,500 to $1,750 and maintain current like debt service. I have a lot of debt from starting up that I stupidly, you know, did without thinking through. You know, but if I can take that time that I have and build my own assets, discover what those are, you know, it's a luxury I can afford because I don't have kids. I don't work for anybody else. My house is paid for, and so my overhead is relatively low. My car is 13 years old.
Mine too.
So, and it's not the choice that anybody can make. So I feel, you know, in a way, very blessed and very lucky to be in this place. You know, there are certain trade-offs. You know, like you know, not being beholden to anybody else makes it difficult to motivate. Sometimes you have to self-motivate all the time. So, you know, this gets into the operating principles, tricks, you know, like knowing the kind of things I tend to do and having experimented with a number of them over the years. So I have a better sense of what I need to do to get over a certain hump. And every year it gets a little bit better. Like I find out some new thing or I found some new trick, but really it's the tricks themselves don't matter. If you look at all the forms that I've made, all of those were a trick that I've tried at one time or another and no longer use every day. So the Immersion Task Planner, I use those every once in a while when there's a lot of stuff happening and I need to keep track of it. But I generally try to keep my daily activities to one or two really important things. So the two categories are, here's deadlines, and here are things I want to do to move myself forward. How many of them can I realistically do? And I know from having practiced you know, what Joel Spolsky calls evidence-based scheduling, I know it takes me about 4 hours to write a pretty decent, you know, 5 to 10 page analysis. I know it takes me about 40 hours to do like a reasonably polished screen. I know it takes me, you know, like maybe an hour to write 500 or 600 decent words. I know that I need to take a nap after 2 hours of heavy conceptual thinking. I know that the first 15 minutes of the day are so precious, I cannot squander them on email. I must jump immediately in to the first creative project of the day and work for 15 minutes. I know that I can get a lot done in 2 minutes. I know that I will punish myself for 2 weeks not cleaning out something the cats did in the basement, and then it'll take 2 minutes to get rid of that. And I go, oh my God. I let 2 weeks of that smell linger when it took me 2 minutes and a painting mask.
Two minutes and a painting mask.
Yeah. So those kind of experiences like accrue, and I think what they all build up into is faith, really, that there's something on the other side of that initial unpleasantness, that uncertainty, that guaranteed, you know, not fun thing to do. And, you know, if it's really bad, I'll watch a World War II movie. And, like, you know, like Saving Private Ryan is, like, it's the movie that I watch if I'm feeling really unmotivated. I watch that as these guys died so we could be free. And to save that boy from his mom back in the Midwest, and they were fighting the Germans, and they didn't want to, and they were, like... And then I say, like, I can clean my basement for an hour. I should spend some time with my sister. I should, you know, I tend to be motivated by maybe epic stories I tell myself. yes, another trick. But I can't do it too often because then you become kind of inured to it. So I'm just spitballing now. So
good, Rob.
No, well, obviously, again, a whole ton of things in there. One thing I wanted to pluck out, though, is I was curious, and this is this. You didn't exactly cover this, but but you mentioned a couple different things that I'm wondering about the connection between the two. Basically, is so you went through the creative challenge of NaNoWriMo. And then, because I have read portions of your blog, but I haven't read everything yet, so I notice you're reproducing like a lot of products this month, and I'm wondering if there's like a relation between those kind of things where you go through a certain adventure that increases or changes your capacity, and then that's like a new asset that you apply, and
when
does that occur? How does that occur?
I like crazy epic ideas that seem like they might be doable by me. I think the idea of doing the product a day challenge, which I'm doing for February, it came out of a story my good friend Alan told me once, who's like a real badass. He's the one who taught me what drawing was, like when we were at this game company together. And I remember he was showing, so we had hired him as an artist at RISD. We were starting our game company, and we were doing a concept sketch session on some spaceship design. And so he was there loosening up. He had gone to the industrial design program at UMichigan. And so like he had like a very, he had process that we didn't have. He probably should have been running the company, not us. But we were sketching and I was watching him do this. And it says like, how do you know what's going to come out? He said, I don't. So what do you mean you don't know what's going to come out? How do you say it? No, I'm just sketching it. You know, like, so I see this line and then like, you know, maybe I'll extend it or maybe I'll do this. And then he said, I'm basically thinking on the paper. And that blew my mind. You mean you don't know what's going to come out before you put the pen or the pencil to the paper? He said, nope. And he was utterly confident about it. And it made a big impression. And then the second thing was with the NaNoWriMo, was the daily effort. It gave me, I found that I liked it, which I found like to be a big surprise because I'm very impatient. Usually I'm very impulsive. I want the cupcake now. At the same time, I want really good cupcakes. And that's, so there's that tension between cupcake here, but bad cupcake.
The nasty cupcake.
Pure cupcake. So it's like, I could go there, but, or in the case of certain things like programming, I am so fussy about my code and other people's code too. I'm a holy terror to write code for it because I'm very, very exacting about what good code is. You know, not that I'm a super experienced developer, but, you know, code is beauty. You know, code is like thinking. Mm-hmm. Code is the pure expression of an idea. And something magical happens when you get it right. You know, so I'm one of those people who believes if I spend like, you know, 15 seconds on an application, I know how it's been coded and I know if it's good or bad or not, or the program was an idiot. And that's the kind of, you know, stupid things that go through my head when I'm you know, but so I forgot what I was talking about. We were talking about the challenge, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the NaNoWriMo experience was had taught me things I didn't expect to learn. And I thought that this challenge, combined with what this friend Alan I was telling you about, who also told me that, and on top of not knowing on these things, his father told him something that he used to not really believe in, but it turned out to be true, was that, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you strong. And, or he expressed it in a different way. It was more like, if you can pile as much stress and strain on yourself as you can, it makes you better. That's how he put it. And so you're drawing from that. So it's like, okay, can I do a product a day every weekend? I think I can. I know I'm very good at figuring out, like, you know, loopholes around things to technically meet the show. And I would allow myself to do that. That's what I did with the NaNoWriMo. I said, I'm not going to write 1,667 really, really great words. I'm going to write 1,667 words. And if they come out, they've come out. And I know from experience that some of them might be good. And also, NaNoWriMo isn't about creating a great novel. NaNoWriMo is about getting unstuck on your novel, which is like an important distinction to make. So that's what led into the product a day thing, just to see what would happen. I knew I could probably stick with it. I have a bunch of backlog projects that, you know, I could just take old designs and refurbish, which is what I've been doing over the first few days. But I don't really know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to come. I'm doing the thinking through doing this. And at the end of it, in 30 days, either I'll have, you know, seen... At the end of 30 days, I'll have 30 things that I did. I could point to say, I had this challenge. It was cool. Maybe one of them will be really cool. Maybe one of them will be the hit. Maybe it will raise my... Put me $10 a day more toward my goal of $100 a day to be the minimum. I don't know. And I'm comfortable with that now for the first time. So it's a whole bunch of things that I've learned over the past 7 years that are coming together like this to give me the faith that starting the project and not knowing how it's going to come out is all right. And, you know, it's not like it's like a meticulously designed process or procedure. For me, the principles are less as waypoints as they are kicks in the butt to get moving. You know, so like it can harness like the momentary excitement because it's something I believe in. I believe that sharing what I'm learning in any capacity creates the possibility of connection. And the possibility of connection is what leads to opportunity. If I don't do that, opportunity does not become available. This is why I say, like, if you make something and you don't show it to anyone, it doesn't matter. It just changes nothing. And it changes nothing that you... Well, it might change yourself, let's say that. You might say, like, is this very cool? Like, I learned something about myself. But the real exciting things about being alive is, like, those unexpected things come back to you. And you go, wow, I had no idea that lawyers were billed in 6-minute increments. That's crazy. It makes me a little bit angry, but it's also very interesting. Maybe there's something there. And that's something that I never would have learned if I hadn't put this thing out there. The Emergent Task Planner was something I just made because someone asked me to combine two things. I said, no one's going to want this thing. There's much cooler things that I'm doing. And it turns out that it's the most popular thing. And I had to rethink my entire approach to it. So I was like, why is this popular? What can I do to improve that? How is this different? You know, it creates points of engagement. There's another thing that I try to do, but I'm sort of shy in real public. You know, if I'm at, like, you know, amongst strangers, you know, the idea of having like a prop that you bring with you, you know, so like if I show up at a coffee shop and have my camera with me, this other photographers all of a sudden they see, oh, that guy must be into photography. He's got like he has this lens, which is not like, you know, a super cheap lens. So he's spending some money on that. And it creates over time some impressions. So it's kind of like to use a Harry Potter reference, it's like a port key to a different, to a possible shared space or something like that. Or it creates something that people don't have to come up to you and understand something about yourself. It's like wearing a cool t-shirt. You know, that's, yeah, that would be something.
But what I love about what you're describing here, if I could just like put this is what I like to do, is like process what somebody else said by repeating it back to them in my own words, yep, is you're like the anti-carpetbagger. because all of this stuff is like is tools and techniques of carpetbaggers, but you're doing it for the right reasons. It's about engaging in sharing in the to help somebody overcome their own obstacles, not to take advantage of anybody, right?
Explain to me what a carpetbagger does again. It's been a while since high school English.
Carpetbagger is a person who comes into a war-torn area and it sells services that usually don't provide any benefit to the war-ravaged public.
Okay.
Beleaguered people, taking advantage of beleaguered people.
Ah, right, yeah.
And the internet has its share of carpetbaggers, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say that it's a reflection on my own values. Like, as I mentioned, I developed a severe allergy to marketing at one point. And it's partly predicated on that anti-carpetbagger feeling. Like, I don't like it when people come in and tell me something that they say they can do, but they can't. And this is really, if I cast this in a negative light, it's a kind of distrust of people, you know, that I have to constantly try to overcome. You know, in the second grade, my dad bought me a one of those coin disappearing magic tricks. And I was very excited because it was my first magic. You put the coin in, you slide it in this box. And I love boxes. And it comes out, and it's gone. And so, like, it got jammed, and I was showing this kid in the second grade. And he said, I can fix that. And he confidently picked it up like this, jiggled it a little bit, inspected it, and went, bam! And shattered the thing.
And
he gave it back. Well, that didn't work. And then he ran away. So this is kind of the same impression I have over people who come in and say, I can fix what you have. Because now I ask questions. So what are you planning to do with my magic coin thing? You're not just going to, like, smash it.
Tell me
how you're thinking about this. What do you think the issue? Show me some diagnostic ability here. Let's talk about it. You know, so That's how I approach things. So the reverse of that is, like, when someone asks me for help, or if I'm just in an area where I'm doing sort of things, I don't want to mislead them in any way, and have people think this is this magic thing that only I can do. You know, I also have part of this hacker ethic thing, like, your information should be free. You know, which from reading, like, a book when I was a kid, it's like, wow, yeah, information should be free. When I was in high school, there were two competing computer groups, like in the computer clubs. There was the group, and this was in Taiwan. I went to Taipei American School in Taiwan, so it's an international school there. And in the 80s, like, Taiwan was very well known at the time for pirating Apple II computers, which meant I could afford one because I had one. But getting software was difficult because we're in Asia, and to get any software, you needed to go to the United States and get it. This is like late 70s, early 80s. So, like, every summer, the kids whose parents or whose families would go back to the States, they would bring back a trove of pirated software. They'd gone off the BBSs here. Or they'd have gone to Hong Kong and they'd get the copied stuff from there. And this was currency in the society of the 7th to 9th graders. So they would say, like, what will you do for me if I give you this copy of this wonderful new game that came out?
How about, like, Gemstone Warrior, for instance?
Yeah, for example. Like, you know, like I don't – so I have got a copy of Temple Abshite. No. I'm really looking for Ultima 3. You have Ultima 3? No. You do not exist to me. Or things like just in general knowledge. How do I do this? And some people just use that to create the priesthood of expertise, which I can't stand. And say, like, I could tell you, but I won't. Or they would do it in some passive-aggressive way. So there was that group, and then there was our group who was figuring out stuff. And we said, like, we'll just tell people because we don't want to be in the position of not knowing. If I know something, you should know it too. This was, like, a very, very much part of my creed, I guess, when I was growing up. And the negative aspect of that was we had this thing called the crushing tree. The crushing tree was, what could we do through kindness and generosity to disempower those other jerks? Those people, Ultima 3, I'll give you a copy of Ultima. I remember this one time. There was this German kid who said, you seem like a good guy. Let me give you a copy of Ultima 2, brand new, you know. And so, that's great. I'd love to play Ultima 2. And so he gave me a copy of the disc, and I got home and tried to boot it up, and it wouldn't boot. It wouldn't run. But unbeknownst to, well, maybe he didn't quite realize this, but I was very good at debugging these kind of things. And so I realized he had just gone and erased one of the directory sectors on the track, so some files weren't showing up. I knew how to recover files off a disk. Duh. You know, got any seventh grader worth of salt, you had to do that.
Sure.
So I
recovered
the
disk,
and the next day in geometry, he said, like, so how is number two? He said, a slight grin playing across his face. Oh, well, it's great. And I started describing it, and he got more and more confused. And I didn't say anything about having, like, yeah. I said, oh, there was an error on the disk. But I was able to recover it. And so then at that point, so we could help other people with these kind of issues. And so that was, so we call that the crushing tree. These people, they cannot be allowed to continue to do these kind of falsehoods or disservices or to present these false faces of being a generous person when really they're not. They're just exercising and toying their power with you. Can't stand that. Hate that. So
I would so join that gang you're talking
me
about.
Too.
Yeah, that's awesome.
With the internet, it's like everybody is in that gang now, you know, which is great. Well, certain parts of it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, there's another little piece I wanted to loop around about that I really like what you're talking about. You're also talking about like trust and not using follow up questions to establish trust with new potential creative partners. But also, early on, we talked about this idea of, like, you do the stuff enough, you get to say that you're the thing. I make enough blog posts, guess what? I'm a blogger because you got the evidence to back this up. But I'm guessing, and I heard a friend say this recently, and it really, really just hit me right between the eyes, said, well, when you do that, you're not lying as long as you can deliver what you're promised.
Right.
The only time that makes you into one of these fakers, these intelligent fakers, is when you can't deliver what you promised. Like the friend with the coin disappearing trick, I can fix it. No, you can't. But if it's
friend.
but
I still remember it very clearly. That's how much it affected me.
I had a similar experience with a donut when I was a kid, and his name was Johnny. And I even remember the smell of the air that day. Can I have a bite? Yeah, you can have a bite. He took half that thing out of my hand and ran away. But like this, it's this weird balance of sort of having the temerity to say that you're the thing, even without the credentials, but knowing that you have the skill to achieve that thing, right? And that's different than being a liar or a faker. It's you know you have the skill set through the evidence of your past, right?
Right. Yeah. This is a difficult area for me to engage in. I have very very difficult to say that I'm good at anything. it's, you know, I know there's things I can do, but like when I make a promise to someone, like I just really want to. I hate disappointing people. I really take it far too personally if I deliver something and it doesn't bring delight or it doesn't. Well, there's this one thing. Oh, that's okay. You know, that's I take that more personally than I should, which is why I don't really shill the design services anymore, because, and I'm very picky about taking them on. It's every project that I take on, I'm very aware of that there might be disappointment that's in it. So the safe thing. So the comfort zone for me is like, it's fine for me just to produce these things and put them on a website for people to read for free. No one's getting hurt that way. No one's expectations are being broken. The stuff is already there. This is why the idea of being a stationary designer is appealing to me, because you buy it if you like it. You don't buy it and be disappointed. Or if you are, you return it through Amazon and, you know, no harm, no foul. So, you know, this is like an area that like I find very difficult to really, I guess, promote myself in. Like, so that's, I spend a lot of time vetting projects. I spend a lot of time doing the postmortem if a project doesn't go well. And even when the project does go well, I wonder if they're just being polite or not. You know, so there's a fundamental, there is a lack of confidence. There's a lack of, or it's I take something very personally, or I have unrealistic expectations about what it is I can do. Yes,
quick question, does any of that have to do with the imbalanced weight that we can put into different kinds of feedback, or if we perceive feedback one way or the other? Because a lot of times, like, you can get 100 pounds of positive feedback and like 1 ounce of negative, it like spoils the whole lot.
Yeah. It might very well be related to that. I remember there was that the oatmeal post of that content creator cartoon last year or something like this. And there's this part where he describes, like, you know, he'll get like all this positive feedback. Then one person will hear his stuff, and then they'll be like,
"Yep."
But, I don't know. I don't know how much of that is. I haven't broken it down to really determine what it is. It could just be that I'm just like, you know, being a pansy about it.
You know, I think this is something we need to be a lot more sympathetic towards ourselves about, though. It's like you referred to the oatmeal. I'm going to refer to Charlie Brown as Lucy says to him, come on, quit feeling sorry for yourself. And he's like, why shouldn't I feel sorry for myself? I'm very tenderhearted, right? Mm-hmm. But we're talking about making personal things. This stuff comes from us, and it comes from – look at how much you think about this stuff, right? We've just been talking about this and all this problem solving, all this soul searching, all this real self-knowledge you have to gain in order to be able to make something that you're pleased with. And, you know, it's like you give it to somebody, you present it to somebody, and like, you know what, your soul? Not so shiny in this spot over here.
Yeah.
I don't think you can ever get away from from that. I think that's the creator's lot, I think.
I saw difficulty dealing with it. For example, you might think that on paper I'm good at doing corporate identity because, like, my interview process, the depth to which I can think about what things mean and express those in clear sentences, tie them to specific concepts, and you know, visual cognitive reactions that people have to layout, color, design, emotion, association. Yeah, these are things that I'm good at. But people just get disappointed by the logo you make for them. So it's, and I feel that so strongly, it's like, I can't do corporate identity. It would be, or I can't do it at the level where, I don't know. When I was reading Mike Montero's book, what was it called?
The Design is a Job?
Yeah, Design is a Job. That helped put some things in perspective for me. The idea of you're not being paid to please people, you're being paid to think about something. That was an important distinction recently that I came across. The other thing is, like, you know, maybe I'm just like too embarrassed to charge a lot of money for things because I just want to help people. And I don't want to, like, you know, gouge people. So, but as a business person, like, I have to think more in terms of what's the value that's here. But for many of the people that I'm dealing with on an everyday basis, it's not like, you know, large companies that understand the value of strategic thinking. It's like a mom and pop shop owner who wants a logo. And they like what I do. They like me as a person. So they ask me for some help with that. Or they need a website for something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I'm thinking, like, okay. Or if when I was doing this for real, I'd be charging based on a blended agency rate of maybe $150 to $200 an hour. It's going to require this. I'm going to get this. Need to get the content from people. Someone's going to write it. I know it's probably not going to be these people. I'm just going to be interviewing. And so in my head, I'm building up this giant project to do it the right way. And I know it's going to take a lot of time. I know I should charge a lot of money for it. But I also know that they don't have that money. And, you know, looking at it from their perspective, you know, spending $15,000 on a logo identity or website project is just a giant expense for what they really need. What they really maybe need is just a website, a page that has some things on it. But then what happens is, like, oh, the page now represents me. It's their first experience with presenting themselves publicly in a manner that where they can be judged on how they present. For some of them, for the people who are aware of quality of presentation, for people who are very conscious of appearances, they are looking for a much more expensive product than I can deliver at the price that they have. And I take it very personally. I feel like I'm failing in some way. So I just don't take that. I try not to take that work anymore unless unless I can somehow frame it in my mind that, well, this is good for the community. This is for a friend. which is not a way to make money. but you know, so it's still something that I find very difficult to deal with. I should be listening to your podcast and figure out how you guys are doing it.
we're wrestling with it every day as well. Rob, you were tapping your pen that suggested that there was internal activity going on here.
I take a lot of stimuli from Dave's speaking, and I can't help it.
Air drumming.
And I'm also drumming to things. no, and well, to just speak as far as right-sizing projects is one way to look at that. I mean, different kinds of clients are managing different amounts of risks for different amounts of benefit for different audiences. And that's, yeah, I mean, so it can take some puzzling to find, like, well, mom and pop shops, often they are at that area of, like, they're either going to go clip art or just above it. And unless they have some kind of big personal investment where, you know, maybe it's this is going to be the logo for generations or whatever. I mean, they may not see this. Well, then that would increase the risk of it. Then therefore they would see the value in investing and all that. And, that same process happens, with big clients as well. My day job is working at an agency. So all sizes of clients. I mean, there is no one exact process, and it's
right. It's a little, I find it a little easier to do it in the agency context because you have project managers, you have time, and then the people generally understand that it costs money to do these things. They're willing to pay for it. Whereas it may not be entirely obvious to, you know, the individual entrepreneur who is not familiar with communications or even how much work it takes to do anything. Like the idea that, like, I had to write something about my store, tell you what it's about. I have a store. I sell things. Work with it. You know, that's, well, I can do that, but, you know, this is why I developed that allergy to marketing. It says, like, how can I make putting words in this person's mouth where they really don't know what it is that they're doing, or they don't care in the worst case. So then do I spend 50 hours thinking about it for them for a free pizza? No. I would like to, you know, but no. Well, and this is what creates the essential conflict in me. But, you know, well, and I also don't want to work for larger clients either anymore. It's too much work.
One of the things that off mic Rob has been beating me about the head about, much like Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise in Cannonball Run in the outtakes, is I often cite some of my favorite superheroes that I was growing up with, or like Zorro or like He-Man. And I say, you know, he solves the problem. He gets the hell out of there. He doesn't stand around to say, hey, yes, where's the accolades? You know, he solves the problem and goes away. And Rob says, yes, but we forget that guy's got to eat too.
Or perhaps in He-Man's situation, He-Man doesn't have to eat, right? But at some point Prince Adam, right?
Yeah, Prince Adam.
Yeah, he has to make choices that also lead to him, you know, being fed and whatnot, or people he cares about or what have you. And yeah, I guess he also has a story where that he doesn't have to worry about that so much because he's a prince.
But even Clark Kent has a job, right?
Yeah.
So
does Clark Kent really need that job to live, you think? I mean, does... How can he afford to live in the city?
Writing. Yeah.
So does he live, subsists completely on his writing stuff? Like, does he need any?
Great. Now I know what's going to keep me up tonight. Well, speaking of lateness, I want to respect your time, Dave, and we've already gone over the time that we said we were going to do. So I do want to say, originally, I thought we were going to talk about productivity. I think we did, though. I think we gave a sense of the thinking that goes into the products that you make, because we've talked about your products a lot on the show. Mm-hmm. I've really been enjoying, you know, following along with, like, the blog post you did recently about the Trello board. Rob introduced me to Trello recently, and my wife, who also follows your blog, introduced me to Trello. And your writing crystallized how this could be an interactive emergent task planner, right? Mm-hmm. Tracking the day and having the satisfaction of watching the list pile up and go away.
The emergent task planner is in your heart.
It was here all along.
You have listened to our shows. You know how to speak my language. but also, you know, it's like one of the things that I just want to close by pointing people at your products, because you have the 365 ETP Almanac for sale on your site, which I purchased and downloaded through Gumroad. You know, you give it away for free, but then you have like a different version, a little bit of a fancier version for pay. Yep. And I actually recommend it, because one of the things, like you talked about how you don't use it as much anymore. I think that is a sign of how this thing is a way to train yourself and how to think about your work. Yeah. It's not a crutch to lean on. Again, we're not talking about fostering dependency like the carpetbaggers. We're talking about enabling. Yeah. And one of the chief benefits I've gotten from this thing is, for the first time in my life, a client can come to me and say, how long would it take to do X? And I can give them a number like that, right? I don't have to sit and go, oh, let me write down what all the things are involved. I can say, oh, well, because I've tracked it through the things like the ETP, I have a sense now of what certain jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, what I love about it is it's not meant to be something to be used your entire life, but for somebody like me who found themselves carrying this big tray with all this stuff on it that was falling off, and then me feeling bad because I'm getting emails, people saying, where's the thing? Oh, I forgot, right? I have this thing, this you know, notebook that I can dump all of everything that's tomorrow into, and then as the day goes, I can dump more into it, and then I can get a sense after a couple weeks of reflection, what did these things take? So that's why I think people should go to davidsay.com and check out the products that you got there.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You've given me an idea about how I should approach the marketing for this. Yeah. I used to call the whole series the Printable CEO, because it grew out of this joke from that first post, and it seemed like, oh, there's no one else on Google using this phrase. I can use it as a trademark. But I think the expectation that happened was people think it's part of a complete thought out system, and it never was. So that's been the challenge, because I know or suspect that people are looking for a complete system. And you can see the kind of copywriting that people do to give people like certainty. This product will solve these benefits and they do this. And that's not how I operate. So this thing might. It's a good idea. I laughed. I learned something. But I wouldn't say like, an emergent task planner will solve your scheduling difficulties in the face of chaos.
So it kind of does.
It kind of does, but kind of to me is like it's not as strong as saying like it will. I have a tendency to caveat a lot, but like if I think of it in terms of like it's really a toolkit to discover and give you insight about different aspects of time management or scheduling or how to think about tasks, and it doesn't tie you to something specifically. You can try it and develop the insight this way and keep the parts that you like. That might be a better way of presenting it. It'd be like a Lego technical set or something like that of different awesome looking forms that make you feel cool because they're printed on this paper.
Well, you were talking about how you have been trying to unbox what the ETP is and why people respond to it. I think all of the self-discovery questions you ask yourself that you were laying out for us on the show today, I think the ETP, whatever mojo you poured into that, it forces us to ask those questions. In using it, it's made me ask the questions of not just how much time do things take, but where is my attention going? Because I'm tracking it, because I'm paying attention, because I'm writing it down. And I got some responses from readers or listeners who, when I've gone on about the ETP, saying like, that seems like a lot of work. It's not really. It's more or less of being mindful. And then I have a record, a journal of where my attention has been gone. So when I say like, oh, I'm going to take an hour break, that goes in there. I'm not going to lie to myself about it. And then when I go back 3 weeks later, well, that's why that didn't get done, because look at all these breaks I took. I took a stupid Transformers break, you know, playing with my Transformers toys for an hour and a half when I shouldn't have been doing that. And I marked it. So it gives you some metrics and insights into where your attention is going and how much time things are taking. Right. So it's more than just productivity. It's a self-knowledge tool.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Like there's that whole quantified self movement that I need to look into.
Hmm.
That too.
But also the I would encourage people to check out the Groundhog's Day resolutions post, and this is this thing where you check in every month on your yearly goals, and you can read along at davidsay.com to see when you very earnestly and honestly approach these things. And also there's the Sid and Dave's unnamed podcast where you journal this stuff.
That's a lot of fun.
It's a great show.
Oh, thanks.
You guys are so much fun to listen to.
Yeah, that's what people say. I'm very fortunate to have a friend and creative partner, Sid Caesar, who's a photographer I met maybe 4 or 5 years ago when I knew nobody where I live here in New Hampshire. And my life is immeasurably better from finding, you know, like a creative partner that I can trust and talk about silly things with and serious stuff with. Much like, how did you guys meet, by the way? Did you go to school together, or?
Well, we met.
Cosplaying at the same con, or?
No. We met at a Maiden concert back in 80. No. Actually, so Jersey used to do a podcast called Art and Story, and they started, him and his business partner started a community called Art and Story Supreme. And it was a way to get sort of like a behind the scenes access and interact with and more content that him and his partners were producing. And they were doing some really great mindful journaling that I found very, very instructive. Anyway, just started interacting through that.
Well, there you go. That goes back to one of the earlier points of the discussion is by sharing, it opens up different opportunities, unexpected things. So yeah, Rob and I met because I was sharing stuff online and Rob was sharing stuff online. And then through the stuff he was sharing, and not just blogging, but also making things and solving people's problems. Because one of the ways our first interaction, Rob, was I think you fixed something on the site for us. and then that started the dialogue going and it established my trust with him. And then we realized we had a lot in common. And so we started building a new thing.
Yeah. That reminds me, I should be reaching out more to people. And so thank you very much for finding me somehow and then reaching out and making this happen. I'm a little bit more connected with the world now and feeling positive, even more positive.
Aww.
That's so totally cool. We appreciate you coming here very much, Dave. And I feel confident speaking for Jersey with this. If you would ever be interested in coming back, we would love to have you back as well. Because we barely scratched the surface of what we wanted to cover.
Yeah, I know.
We are comrades now.
Exactly.
Well, okay. Well, then we should wrap this up. So for the folks who are listening to the show, longtime listeners of the show, maybe wondering, where's the quest? You're going to be talking about the quest today. I thought we've moved it back one episode. So you guys get 2 more weeks to work on the third Lean Into Art quest. So the new due date will be, I'm looking it up on the notes, February 27th for Evil or Just a Jerk is the name of the quest. And that can be found at leanintoart.com/quests. And then, but before you go there, I think you need to go to davidsay.com because that is one of my favorite things to read in the entire world. And there's neat stuff. The creative cootie catcher is a stroke of brilliance.
Oh, yeah.
Love that thing.
That is awesome.
I have been sitting on this idea for 6 years or whatever it is. And finally.
I can't believe all the stuff you're cranking out this month. And it's like, now I have to totally stay tuned. And plus, on day four, I don't know. I'm sure you've received feedback on the Emergent Task Planner, but so I've been using it as well and been enjoying it. But also my wife gave me a half size, the American, letter, 8.5 by 11. So it's whatever,
digest size
in a quarter by, what's that?
5.5 by 8.5.
Five and a half by 8.5. Thank you. And it's a what's it called? Oh yeah, a circa notebook, right?
Oh yes. Yep.
And I was hunting for I have these big Emergent Task Planner sheets, but this little notebook, and you go and produce on the 4th of February, the half sized.
did you make any?
What's that? Not yet. I'm going to be printing them out.
Yeah. So yep. I'm looking into talking to my printer now, about producing some of those.
I will buy some.
Yeah, they'll be A5 format though, probably.
Oh, okay.
That works out a little bit better.
Cool.
excited. All right. Well, thank you again, Dave. This was super, super fun. And yes, we'll be in touch after the episode goes on the site to see if we can hassle you some more. Rob, thank you for setting up this impromptu recording because my computer failed me today.
Thanks, Jersey.
Until next time, everybody, thank you for downloading, listening. I have been Jersey Droz of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter. And our guest, Dave Say of
DavidSay.com.
DavidSay.com. Nice.
And Dave Say on Twitter.
Yeah.
Dave Say on Twitter. Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leans aren't leans. Thanks for listening.